Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So here it is, episode one of the Early Work Lost episodes. How exciting. As you can see from the title, the guest this week is Hugh Dennis, absolute British comedy legend, TV and radio. You'll know him from Mock the Week, brackets R.O.P., a single tear rolls down my cheek. You'll know him from, that sounded like Early Work, didn't it there? You'll know him from The Now Show, which continues to live on forever and ever, never to die. Outnumbered, there's all sorts of stuff. He's done loads of stuff. I think he did a history documentary about buildings, about old buildings. Anyway, watch all of his stuff. He's obviously absolutely fantastic. And I was very thrilled and very lucky to have him on Early Work. And I feel quite bad that this episode didn't get released. We recorded it, I think, in 2021. It's taken until now for me to release it. He probably did have something to plug. That's why he did it. And of course, it's long in the past now, and I can't remember what it was. So here we are. But it's a fantastic episode. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Some revelations in there. His real name comes out. I get to use the phrase Parisian disco, if I'm not mistaken. He's obsessed with military precision timings. He's like a nerdy, geography-obsessed little boy who obviously would later go on to be called Desky, as revealed on Taskmaster. There you go. There's another of his credits. Taskmaster. He ends on a murder mystery with some classic Hugh Dennis voiceover work in there that you'll know and love. Thank you very much to Hugh for his time. Thank you to Neil Fern, who did the edit on this episode a long time ago and helped me getting it all together for the release of these. Thank you, of course, to Global and Radio X for allowing me to release all of these episodes. And without further ado, episode one of the lost episodes, Hugh Dennis. Now, Hugh, if I had to guess what you were like at school, and I do, because it's the first format point of the show, what I've gone with is boffin, narc, swat. I reckon that Hugh Dennis is the epitome of a teacher's pet. And not just because you gleefully give the correct answers on Mock the Week every week. I would just, I'd say if a teacher said, I need someone sensible to take this note to another teacher, they wouldn't have to think twice about asking you.
No.
Obviously, you're very smart because, and presumably got exceptional grades given your university destination and most of your output ever since. But also, I'm going to predict you were very popular despite all of this because I think you were probably good at sport based on the fact I know you play a lot of football now. I don't think that really carries on that much in adult life if you weren't smashing it at school. I'll also put you down as a cricket captain in this guess. Possibly went on some sort of cricket or football tours abroad with school, which were formative in social experiences, maybe where you got drunk for the very first time. Because of your studiousness and likability, I'm going to put you down for a leadership role. I often guess that my guests were some sort of prefect, but that's usually because comedians seem like they wanted to be a prefect. Whereas for you, I think you probably... I've talked about this a lot on this podcast. I ran for head boy to do the speech and lost.
How do you run for head boy?
I'm fine with it.
Were you voted on?
Oh, we had hustings, yeah.
Oh, no, we didn't do that.
Wait, before you say this, I've got this right then, because I've literally
go on.
You've got head boy written all over you, but you wouldn't have been desperately campaigning for it. You'd have just been the obvious choice and would have been sort of lifted into it and accepted it, like, yeah, if that's what you all want. that's correct.
Yeah, no, that is correct, yeah.
I've got one final prediction. Yeah. So these are all, they're pretty standard and I'd say pretty obvious, but this final one. going out on a limb here to say that I reckon you often volunteered to run a stall at the school fete because you were too nice to say no. Possibly a tombola, possibly a guess how many jelly beans are in this jar. But for the sake of the Mock the Week crowd, I will say it was a jam table. Is any of this, other than the head boy thing, correct?
That last thing is simply not true because we didn't ever have a school fete. I've never heard of any school that had a school fete. Who had school fates?
Come on. No. The schools have school fates.
No, we didn't have a school fate. No one had a school fate.
Well, where does the phrase school fate come from if there was no such thing?
I don't think there is a phrase school fate. There's a village fate. There might be a parish fate, but there's no school fate in my world.
We used to have school fates, definitely, well, big time. And you were the sort of guy who'd be at the jam table.
I could conceivably have done that. I agree with you. The pretty much everything in that is true. So I was I swotty? I wasn't particularly swotty actually, but I was at university, but I wasn't at school,
right?
Which is a bit odd. And I was head boy, and I was.
You were head boy, and you weren't elected. You just got.
No, you just
like
got,
it wasn't like a campaign.
No. You just got asked if you would do it, and I was.
And did they ask one person? They didn't go like, oh, do any of you five want to do it? And then four people say no, thank you. They just went, it's got to be Hugh.
They went, it's got to be Hugh, or Pete, as I was at that point, in a slightly confusing twist in my life. but no, I was head boy, and I was head boy because I was quite academic, although I didn't actually do that well in my A level, so I didn't get outstanding grades in any sense.
Okay.
In my A levels. But I was the captain. I wasn't the captain of cricket. I was the vice captain of cricket.
Oh, come on. That's pretty close.
But I was the captain of football and I was the captain of rugby. So, I did a lot of sport. It wasn't really a very good sporting school, though. I was captain of rugby because I was the one person who could catch it, kind of thing.
Did you just have leadership just running through you? I mean, you're the captain of Mock the Week, by the way.
I'm only the captain of my side. I'm not even that.
But there's no other captain, anymore. So you are the sole captain of all of these things. Football.
The whole lot.
Rugby. Head boy. Nearly cricket. Mock the Week.
Cricket I was really bad at. But because I was the captain of the other two.
Vice-captain.
Yeah, because I was sort of, as you said, I was the kind of boy that if you gave a note to me, I would take it to the headmaster or another.
Is this
teacher.
The only reason then? Is this the reason that you got captain? Is because you were seen by the actual authority figures, teachers, as just being so reliable and sensible?
I think I was very reliable, yeah. But I like to think I was quite good at sport.
Yeah, and sorry, and also the innate
as
talent
well,
that you
the
had.
The innate footballing talent. It wasn't that, as I say, it wasn't a very good sporty school. Except in some respects, in football, we came second in a thing called, it was a public school in London, it was a day school called University College School, which is in itself rather difficult. Because if you're filling in a form when you leave school, and there's always a little box that goes university, then there's a sort of a forward slash thing, and it goes college, and there's another one which goes to school, and you're meant to cross out two and then write in the name of your educational establishment. And I just looked like I'd copied it out, and everybody thought, no, he's a moron, he's just gone.
Sounds like someone very bad at improv coming up with a name for a school.
Yeah, but we came second in the national public schools, wait for it, six-a-side football tournament. Who plays six-a-side football? No one, except a group of public schools who've all decided this is the best way to compete. And we came second. Yeah, and I got nutmegged in the final. I was a defender. I got nutmegged by whoever he was, the centre-forward of Oldham Grammar School. And therefore, they won, we lost.
How did your teammates react to that? Were you popular enough that everyone was sort of like, ah, this happens, or were people angry?
I think they felt a bit sorry for me because it was such an obvious mistake. I've got very bow legs, by the way, as well. So being nutmegged to me is, I can't actually stop it. If you get it, if you get it through the right bit of my legs, there's no way of preventing that. But
listeners, a weakness has been revealed. Oh, if ever God, you find yourself so playing in a six, maybe an eight-a-side tournament with you, Dennis, you know where to aim.
Yeah. You have to chip it through just above the knee. That's where you have to get it.
So would you say that defender is not really the natural position for someone who is so easily manipulatable on the football pitch?
No, possibly. Possibly. But again,
what type of defender were you? Were you a John Terry kind of captain centre-back leading with brute force?
Well, no, not really. It was such a long time ago that the position you really wanted to play in defence then was one which no longer exists in a modern football team, which was sweeper. So you played behind...
You were the sweeper?
I was the sweeper. And I played behind the centre-half, sort of clearing everything up. Everybody else's cock-ups. I ran side to side of the pitch, clearing up nonsense.
Old, reliable Pete Dennis. Just, he's sensible, he'll just clear it. We can play foolishly at centre-back because old... Yeah. Sensible Pete is going to sort this out at the back.
He'll run across quite fast and sort it out.
And then once get nutmegged.
Yeah.
Did you go on a... I mean, as you say, it wasn't really... If it wasn't really a sporting school, maybe not.
I did predict
that you went on some sort of football tour abroad.
Yeah, we went to Holland to play football. We went to...
How did that go?
Amsterdam. Well, they were clearly at that point playing total football and we were playing North London football. So I'm thinking probably it didn't go that well. I can't remember really. But I remember...
Did you have formative social experiences on that tour?
I sort of did on a... I did on a rugby tour. We went to Paris on a rugby tour. And I think I... first sort of proper snog, I think, on the rugby tour, as far as I remember. Can't remember how old I was. Sort of embarrassingly old, I suspect.
To me, a rugby tour is an extremely laddie group. Extremely laddie experience. The rugby tour you'd be describing, I presume it wasn't a mixed rugby tour. So you, what, snogged a Parisian?
Yeah. So we played a... We played a French school, which some lycée in Paris, I think, who beat us, I think, clearly. I can't remember. But there was a sort of disco afterwards, their school and us. And, I can't go into the details, mainly because I can't remember them. But
that is, I mean, just what a story for your first snog. Most people's is like... Mine was just like at my friend's house, and then it was with his girlfriend's mate who was there, so it was out of pure convenience. And yours is having just been defeated.
Yeah, I think so. You, by a French
lycée. Rugby.
Yeah.
You have a snog at a Parisian disco for the very first time.
Yeah, it sounds more glamorous now you're saying it.
No. Oh my God, it's incredible. They gave you a... I can't even believe you had a... You got to go to the mixed school disco. I find that... They're like... I don't know, to have an international rugby tour and then go, do you guys want to come... We're having this party afterwards. Do you want to come to that? I find a bit mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I never went on one of these sporting tours.
I think
tours.
Also because I was the captain of that particular team, I was regarded as a sort of trophy by the... Which is certainly not something that I was regarded as in London. I think that's probably why it happened in Paris, to be honest. Yeah.
So they won the rugby and they won the Pete Dennis trophy as well.
Yeah, the very unsatisfactory snog outside in the cold in Paris. Yeah.
That is such a great story of a first snog. I'm so jealous. But I was right. I can't believe I even got that right, which is the formative social experiences on a sporting tour. I mean, it wasn't bang on, but it was pretty close. That's pretty accurate then. I mean, a lot of these predictions are usually quite accurate, but the only thing I missed was the school fate thing, simply because they didn't exist. But you have agreed that if they did exist, that would have been you.
So I'm going to take it. You also said that my exam results would have been very good, and actually they really weren't. So my A-level results, in which I was predicted really good A-levels, I completely cocked up my A-levels. And I got, I think my... what did you get in your A-levels? just so I...
Oh, thanks for asking. I got 3 A's and a B or something.
Beautiful.
There was a B in there. The B was in the topic I was then doing at uni, and it was the easiest one, and I just had a shocker. Oh, but I got
well, you get,
A's
you had
and
a shocker
B.
to get a B. Right, okay. So I
well,
got...
I mean, it was just like a nailed on. It was just like the most nailed on A possible, and then it's the one that I screwed up compared to the others.
So I got a brother who's 2.5 years older than me, and he's very clever. So I decided that in my A levels, I wouldn't do any of the subjects apart from geography, which I wanted to do at university. I wouldn't do any of the A levels that he'd done, even if I was good at them, which was nuts. I mean, what a weird way to choose your A levels. And I did maths and physics, which is kind of a bit strange, actually. And in maths, I got an A in geography, and then I got a B in maths, and then in physics, which I really didn't understand from the first week of doing it, I got an E in physics.
Wow.
And I sent it back to be remarked, or my parents did, or the school did, or something. And it wasn't changed, but they did say it was a very high E. It was nearly a D. And I remember the day that the result came, and I thought, you know, they come in capital letters on that letter that you get. And I thought, they've just forgotten to join the ends of this E up. Sure.
What, you were really that convinced it was a B?
That must be a B. Well, I think...
I'm trying to think of, like, a physics E equals MC squared joke where you get the results and it says MC squared, but I'm not even sure that is physics, so...
No, it is.
I mean...
Yeah, it is physics.
It is?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to trust your judgment, mate.
No, you'd be right to. Anyway, it all worked out fine in the end.
Yeah, you don't actually have to show your A-level results to get on Mock the Week.
No, not really. Although I have.
Yeah. What prompted that... what made you go... I mean, you've already done a funny thing, which is to actively make your life harder at A-level, which is just like, it, to me, shows the sort of self-sabotaging streak you need to be a comedian. The sort of thing you just go, oh, it's kind of funny to do this. It massively ruins my life, but whatever, it's funny. Like how comedians, if, you know, stand-ups especially, if something bad happens in a stand-up's life, the instinct is, great, there's 5 minutes. I've got a new 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Every disaster is an anecdote, isn't it? Which I've used. It's taken a while to use that particular one for me. But it's now
finally I've invented a podcast.
It's now paid off.
Exactly. It's all always there in the back. So you left the desk and then you were like, what's the moment? Because you're doing geography at Cambridge and you're called desk because that's how
hard
working
you are. Well, only amongst a select group of people. I mean, it's not the whole university isn't calling me desk, clearly.
So, right. So you're not walking through the campus and everyone's going, desko.
Well, maybe a bit.
Sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
No, no.
And then it just seems like quite a leap to just go from that and then you're just in comedy. So, like, then you just suddenly start doing comedy. Is it as simple as that? You just kind of randomly went, oh, yeah, I'll just do some stand-up.
Yeah, sort of. But in Cambridge, you know, there's this thing called the Footlights, which had produced, you know, the Pythons and Fry and Laurie and Emma Thompson, you know. People like that. Which before I went, hard as it is to believe, I'd never heard of. Right, I didn't know they existed.
Really?
And I relied on, I had a mate who I'd been at school with, who was at the college next door, who about halfway through the second year went, have you heard of this thing, Footlights? And I went, no, not really. Well, look, I think you and I should write a sketch, maybe, and you take it along, and you perform it in front of this group of eight of them, their committee, and if we're any good, you get to perform it the next night, sort of in public. And I went, do you want to do that? And I went, yeah, that sounds, yeah, okay. So he convinced me to do it, and I can't even remember what the sketch was, but we wrote probably a terrible, terrible sketch, and we took it along, and someone laughed, and that was literally it. Then I was sort of because, as you know, it is incredibly seductive, isn't it? Laughter.
Yeah.
That sort of at root, that's sort of why you're doing it.
Oh yeah. So did you then? So you then got invited to come back the next night and perform it to an audience.
So we performed it to an audience, and then, you know, we wrote a bit more. And at the end of that year, I got or was asked to be in the sort of shows, you know. So the Footlights did a, they did a late night one term, they did a panto, and they took a show to Edinburgh and toured it around the country, ended up at Edinburgh, actually. Or maybe it was the other way around. Maybe we started at Edinburgh and then worked our way around the country. But it was a sort of... I'm pretty sure it doesn't work like this now, but it was sort of... It was like, almost like a professional theatre tour. It was in really quite big sort of venues and ending up in Edinburgh. Have I lied there? Am I imagining that? Where did we do it? Maybe you did... Maybe we didn't tour it. Maybe I'm conflating.
I think in those days that Footlights had a reputation big enough that
maybe we didn't tour. Anyway, we took it to Edinburgh. We certainly took it to Edinburgh, and you know, we did a month selling out the George Square Theatre, which is quite sort of a big place.
That's like a few hundred seats, right?
Yeah.
Or is it bigger than that?
You'd have to ask Steve Punt. He knows all that interior, how many seats there are thing.
Steve Punt's not available for the podcast, but... No.
But we did it. We certainly did it in quite a few places. I know we did... I think I remember what we did. We did like 2 weeks or something at the Arts Theatre, which is a big professional theatre in Cambridge, and then went to Edinburgh, I think is what we did. I don't think we did anywhere in between, but to be honest, can't remember.
And for context, for listeners, so like when you do a... If you do... Often your first experience of Edinburgh... is doing a show to, at most, in a sort of 40-seater.
Yeah.
Usually to about six people. So, like, for someone to go... I mean, obviously, different time, etc., and it's the Footlights, so it's got the heft of the Footlights. And the Footlights still do play big venues. But to get to go and have your first experience in, I presume, very well-selling, you know, a few hundred-seaters.
Yeah, and, you know, it was a ridiculous sort of thing because the Footlights, because it had such a reputation in the past and because, you know, 4 years or so before I went, the Footlights show was Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Emma Thompson, Tony Slattery and a guy called Paul Shearer and Robert Bathurst, I think. Because it had been so successful, they'd gone straight from... Edinburgh, the show in Edinburgh, to BBC One or BBC Two or something. And there was nothing in between. It's literally nothing in between. So all subsequent shows sort of played on that reputation, really. So Footlights sold a lot of tickets to the extent that Footlights, as a university society, if you think about your kind of university photographic society or whatever it is, of a canoeing club or whatever it was, Footlights... had their own car. We bought a car, which we...
Then now you sound like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We've got a van.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're fine.
We had a red Ford Cortina that you could borrow.
Bought by the society.
Bought by the society, yeah, which you could borrow and, you know, sort of drive around if you felt like it.
That is amazing that you had this reputation. So people obviously are going to watch your group of Footlights on the basis that, well, the last group immediately have a show on BBC One, so you are seeing the next version. You're seeing the next people to be on BBC One before they're on BBC One, was, I presume, how all these things get sold and what people would have been thinking when they went.
Yeah.
And that is kind of like, go and watch the Cambridge rugby team. The last Cambridge rugby team won the World Cup.
Yes, exactly.
So now you get to see them before they win the World Cup. You get to see them before they're in Wembley. This is going to be huge. But
had the thing whereby when you did it in Cambridge at the Arts Theatre, the Guardian, sort of national newspapers, came to review the show. And... which I still quote it. But basically, the quote for me, it just went, Hugh Dennis, or Peter Dennis, as I was saying, went, Peter Dennis, a tall young man. That was it. That was the... That was the quote.
Well, yeah. Peter Dennis, a tall young man, and then nothing else.
Yeah.
Did you put that on posters?
Yeah,
for
no, I've used that for a year. Tall young man. But now,
I've had them.
People have got taller. I'm not as tall, or I'm shrinking. I don't seem tall, do I? I'm not tall next to Dara, am I?
You're not as young anymore either. No, I don't know if you can still get away with any of it.
Yeah. Okay.
Just you have to have man yeah, the Guardian. Yeah. I've had ones where it's like, I've had a number of reviews actually that start with looking like the kid you bullied at school. Rhys James comes onto the stage, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, well, hang on. So you're just assuming everyone who reads reviews is a bully, are you? The kid you bullied at school.
Yeah, you, specifically.
not who was bullied at school. The kid you bullied at school.
And is that true? Were you bullied at school?
No, I did the very clever and cowardly tactic of becoming the bully's mate.
Oh, that's clever.
I was like the little sidekick, just for pure protection, so that because I was such bully fodder, because I was tiny. Yeah. I was just like, oh, who's the bully? All right, I'll just befriend him and make little snide comments and be the sidekick.
Did you make him tea and stuff? Go and get him curly whirlies and stuff. What were you doing?
Foot massages and stuff. No, I was just like, I was the wisecracker. You know, I was just there. You know, making funny comments quietly to him, and then he would then say them. You know,
you're
how like politicians...
Jester. You're like a jester in a medieval court.
Yeah, I was absolutely like a court jester. And you know when like a vice president or a president has someone in their ear saying, this is so-and-so.
Yeah.
He's a journalist from this, so that you can go, oh, hi, and then you know all the information. I was kind of like that, but just for like little funny comments.
But what were you suggesting? What were you suggesting to the bully? Little nasty things to say.
Yeah, little roast battle lines. So when I got asked to do roast battle, I was like, oh, finally! As long as I can get Luke back to say the lines, I'm happy to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I've got to say, I'm very intrigued by what you've brought, because it sort of seems like, well, I didn't do anything. So, I mean, I am really wondering what this might be.
What I brought, there was a read you thing. Oh, well, I've found very, very little, because I don't think I did very much of it. What I have discovered, you'll like this, because I think it's an insight into the man who did geography and the middle-aged man who's fascinated by roots. I found this, okay. Which is the first day. It's my diary. It's the first, I was 11, I think. And I went on a primary school trip to Conwy in Wales, right? And this is sort of creative writing. They say, please write a report on the morning, afternoon and evening of Saturday. And I've taken this very, very literally. I'm doing it in terms of an actual, really, report on it. Right, here we go. Shall I read it to you? Is this how this
works?
Yes, please,
yeah. Is
this the format? Right.
Yeah. You're a big fan, are you?
Yeah, big fan. Here we go. So this is my news report on my morning, afternoon and evening of Saturday. And then there's no date, but it's sometime in the summer of 1973. I arrived at school at 8:25. I think it's crucial to get the time absolutely. Feeling very excited. With me were my mum and dad. The first thing I did when I arrived was to carry the water flasks from the cloakroom to the coach. So there again, you're right in your estimation of what I would have done. I wasn't only my own water flask, I was carrying everybody's.
The water flask,
all
trusted to carry everyone's water flasks.
All the parents were standing around talking to each other or to their children. At 9:08... We finally left. Soon we were on the M1 and we passed many strange vehicles, including two...
But sorry, you passed what? Mainstream vehicles?
No, many strange vehicles.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
right.
Including, wait for it, two pleasure boats and a very large caravan on a lorry. At 9:10, which can't be right because we only left... it was 8 minutes to... Oh, right, so it took 20 minutes. Okay. At 9:10, we passed Watford and went into the Chalk Hills. How do I know they were Chalk Hills? Early fascination with geography. Soon, we were in Luton and saw the famous factories of Vauxhall and Whitbread. At 10:25, very keen on time, we made our first stop at Watford Gap. We entered Birmingham at 10:22. I clearly had a watch, didn't I? And went over the famous spaghetti. I think I've missed out junction at this point.
Yeah.
Went over the famous spaghetti from which I saw a radio mast. After spaghetti, we moved on to the M6, from which I saw many more radio masts, wooden and metal. Also on the M6, we stopped at a Trust House Forte service station. Immediately after this, Stephen Young and I had a second game of chess. What were we doing? Stephen won the first game, but luckily this one ended in stalemate, and after that I decided to go to sleep, but unfortunately I did not. After the M6, we went on to the M54, and soon after we joined it. Hang on. We made our third stop, where we had our lunch, mine consisting of Jaffa cakes and sandwiches. Nice.
Wow.
After that, we made steady progress, soon reached Wales at 1:20 and crossed the River Dee. We didn't go into them, but on our left, we saw the Welsh Mountains. About 2 hours later, we arrived in Conwy after a long and interesting journey and discovered the coach was stopping a long way from Beechwood Court, and we were faced with the prospect of carrying our suitcases up the steep hill to the house. But luckily, they were brought up by taxi. I would like to say this was a very ordinary state primary school. That sounds incredibly posh. Me and Stephen Young and Nicholas Krieger all share a little room, a little bungalow in the grounds of Beechwood Court, which we immediately surveyed. It's quite nice, with 4 beds, 1 unused, 2 wardrobes, 2 radiators, 2 mirrors and a chest of drawers. It is painted. Tonight we climbed Conwy Mountain. It was a long and interesting walk. And that's it.
I mean, okay, I've got a lot of notes.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. If they about the timings...
I mean, well, the timings comes into it, which is, I mean, yeah. Just like what? So any time anything happened when you were a kid, you just looked at your watch and made it... Wrote down. Like you're in the military.
Yeah.
The other thing is, yeah. I'd just like to reiterate in my prediction how I opened, which is Boffin, Narc, SWAT.
Yeah.
Because... There's a few things here. You, chess, second game. When you said that, it was like, right, we had our second game of chess on a school trip. You were so excited by the wood and metal radio masts.
Yeah. Well, listen, there's...
wood and metal.
I know, there's a second section here, which goes, after lunch, we went to the aluminium factory and saw Teflon saucepans being made. It was very interesting the way they put on the Teflon. First, there was molten aluminium, which is eventually made into the shape of saucepans. And when they were cool, they were coated with Teflon. Yeah. Hey.
Unbelievable. I mean, what an... it's pretty extensive M1 knowledge for a kid, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you just take it in your surroundings, but just to even say the M1 and not the road motorway as a kid.
Yeah, well, I lived very near the M1. I think it was...
The detail. Yeah. Watford, Luton. I really like the way you say... We got to pass the famous factories of Vauxhall.
Yeah,
as if this has been talked about for years. I mean, I've seen these factories on TV. This is incredible.
Has this show incidentally ever sent anyone into a sort of crisis? Because I'm feeling that that might happen to me.
Oh yeah. It's a mix between people going, oh my God, I was actually a genius, and people going, Jesus Christ, what have I agreed to do?
What am I doing?
There was one moment, Hugh, in your reading of it, where you did your voiceover instinct kicked in, and you paused to momentarily sort of advertise Jaffa cakes.
Oh, okay.
You sort of delivered it. It was great. You sort of were just reading it normally, and then you sort of went, "I had a lunch of," and then you looked at me on the Zoom and very slowly went, "Jaffa cakes," and I was like, "Oh, this guy, he's just got it, hasn't he? He just knows. He just knows when to switch it on because they, you know, you never know who could be."
I've
listening.
Never done a biscuit. Actually, that's a lie. I have done a bit. I did a biscuit called McVitie's Misbits, which was a McVitie's biscuit. but without any bits in it. I mean, it makes sure it does what it says on the tin. So you, where you would normally expect a sultana, there was nothing. And I think I had to say, McVitie's miss bits. Life's a lot better when you miss bits. That's all I can remember.
Wow, I love it. It's electric. That is electrifying to hear that. Well, that is that's a pretty good insight into the child. How old would you have been then?
I think I was possibly 11, possibly still 10.
It's just very, yeah. I mean, it's very detailed, it's very literal.
Yeah.
It's like, I know you said, yeah, it's a report, but it has military precision. It's...
I do like to know where I am, Rhys.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
I like to know where I am. That's all I'm saying.
Is there... do you have any other stuff?
Oh, God, yeah. So that was my... I'll show you my school journey folder there. Can you see that? I painted that afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
Lovely.
Then I left that school and went to secondary school. And at secondary school, oh, hang on, this might be from, this is even earlier. This is the story of flight. A project on the story of flight. It's not very good, to be honest. It's chapter one, bird men. Man has always wanted to fly. He looked at the birds and tried to copy them. They made wings of real feathers held together by wax. Who did? I don't answer that question. He used to tie them to his arms and legs and jump off towers and try to fly. Lots of people killed themselves because they didn't realise they were not strong enough. Yeah, it's good enough.
It's all very literal. It's very true. That's less detailed. You've given up on the information overload.
But then there's lots of pictures. I drew a magnificent picture of a Hawker Siddeley Vulcan bomber. That's all I'm saying. I think that's very much... It's down the same sort of route, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah, information. It's nice.
Information,
it's
information,
You know what you like.
And then when I was... this was also 1973, but I think I'd started at a new school by then. I then wrote a ballad about my class. We all had to try and write stuff. So, yeah. Oh, 1974. Yeah, there it was, 1974. And I was in a class called 5D, and it was D because of Mr. Dean. So I wrote this ballad about all my mates in the class who were Jacobs, a Gershon, called Jeremy Bliss, all in the class. And so I wrote this. Here you go. Do you want to hear this?
Yes, please.
This is the Ballad of 5D, 1974. The ink, it flew from Jacob's pen across the dreaded room and landed on young Gershon's head, who fell down with a boom. The class, it fell on Jacob's, who felt it was his doom. Then Gershon picked him up and threw him right across the room. The dreaded dean, he entered and took Bliss by the hair. "I'm innocent," the young boy said. "I wasn't even there." "It wasn't me," said Jacob's. Said Gershon, "No, nor me," said dreaded dean to all the class. 340, class DT. The muffled cry of, "Oh, no," came rising from the floor, and there sat poor old Jacobs. He could not take much more. The time, it was 3:40. The DT had arrived, and all the class of 5D were doing 5 times 5. The 5 times 5 was boring. The class were like old men, except for Peter Dennis, who was chewing on his pen. "I've swallowed it," he cried aloud, the loudest he could shout. "It's stuck inside my throat, I think. How shall I get it out?" "Swallowed what?" said Mr. Dean, who raised a piercing eye. "My pen," said Peter Dennis. "I hope I shall not die." The ambulance, it did arrive and took the lad away, said Mr. Dean to all the class. "That's all, boys, for today." Dennis was back next morning as happy as could be. His pen was in his hand again through clever surgery. There is a moral to this tale, and this is what it be. If after school you're ravenous, it's best to wait for tea.
That is so good. That's incredible. That's like a Spike Milligan poem.
Yeah. It must have been influenced by someone or something. But anyway, there you go.
It's when you were 11.
It's when I was a bit
the meter. The meter of it alone is like flawless. This, it's so, the syllables are perfect in every line. Yeah. The way you word things is, you know, the tenses change in the way poetry does. There's the way speech happens. I mean, also, true to form, there is a line in there which is the time it was 3:40, which is, yeah, I mean, classic you.
No, absolutely, man, yeah. I mean, for goodness sake, I like to know where I am.
What a great... So the ink is flying around. Also, like, there's themes in it. It's thematic. There's motifs because it starts... What's interesting, it starts with ink is flying around the class.
Yeah.
And you think that's just, you know, that's just setting the scene. That's not really relevant. And then the end of the story is that someone, you...
Me.
...swallows a pen. It's like a foreshadowing opening line. I cannot believe how good that is. The fact you were 11.
Yeah, no, I was 11. But, yeah, that got in the school magazine.
Unbelievable.
That was in the school magazine.
Well, so it should. And also, you had a school magazine, did you?
We had a school magazine. You had a school fate, so you can shut up. No one... no one has a school fate, do they?
Well, I can see where your school fate budget went on all the bloody printing, mate. So everyone wrote a ballad, I presume, and...
Well, everyone had to write something. I also wrote another one, but this may give you an indication of what... So I wrote a ballad about St. Swithin. Do you know the thing about St. Swithin? And St. Swithin's Day and it raining for 40 days and all that stuff. Do you know that?
Okay.
If it rains on St. Swithin's Day, which is... I can't tell you when it is, but it... it will then rain for 40 more days. Right. So I wrote this ballad about St. Swithin. I don't know why, but it's the last bit that I like. I'll read it to you anyway. He goes, there lived a man in Winchester of wisdom and renown. We think of him in summer when the rain comes pouring down. His name was Bishop Swithin, a good and trusted man who showed his wrath to Winchester for the breaking of his ban. He ordered, when he passed away, his body be outside, and not within the noble church, a place for men of pride. And when the humble bishop died, they carried out his order. They dug a grave and placed him in, outside the church's border. A century did pass away, the bishop lay to rest. But even so, the chapter and dean were painfully distressed. They said it's wrong for such a man of fame and grace, to be interred outside the church in such a lowly place. And so the masons set to work to build a splendid shrine of stone and wood and colours laid in intricate design. And so one sunny July morn, they opened up his tomb. And as they did so, heavily, the skies began to boom. And as they brought him into church, the rain began to fall, and never ceased for 40 days to show the bishop's gall. And still the saint reveals his rage, for rain on Swithin's Day will not let up for just as long, or so some people say. Right, so I wrote that. And then at the bottom, at the bottom, I've gone, because, you know, honesty and everything, I've gone, this ballad was written with a lot of discussion with my mother, who gave me suggestions.
Oh, that is so sweet.
She
gave her a writing credit.
She also wrote three lines of the last verse. And then at the top, my teacher's gone, thank you for telling me this, but I imagine the actual execution of the poem, choice of words, etc., is almost entirely your own. Well done. 18
out of 20. They're going to back you. Yeah. If you're going to be that honest and you're going to have the sensible reputation that you've got, yeah, they're going to go,
yeah,
I'm sure you didn't nick it, mate. I mean, that is, again, it's a beautiful poem. It's 15th of July, St. Swithin's Day, it turns out. Producer Neil has just messaged to say it's a useless fact that he knows. And you do say one July morn is when you dig him up. These are so insanely well written that I'm blown away
by the ballads.
Being 11.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, they're incredible. I mean, I know you handed these in for sort of homework and stuff. The Ballad of 5D especially, would there have been any kind of reading that allowed to the class at any point?
Oh, possibly. Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember it if there was.
Okay, so at least it didn't go terribly then, or you would...
No, I would have remembered that, yeah. Remembered that.
Those are beautiful
reading,
poems.
Actually, reading something out at school is one of the reasons I think I ended up doing what I'm doing now. So in my final year at school, I was head boy, as you have pointed out. And so I had to do a speech on speech day to the whole of the school. Now, because I'd finished my A-levels, about, you know, 3 or 4 days before speech day, I went with a load of mates, there were five of us, to play golf. I'd never played golf, but I had a couple of mates who played golf, and we went up to Stanmore Golf Course, and we went round it as a five, which you just don't do. And we held up two people behind us, and we got a bit freaked out. And so we decided to play very fast. So not really understanding any of the etiquette or whatever you do, I went and stood on the green while my mate, Bryn, hit the ball towards the green. Now, I wasn't looking when he did that. And the ball, genuinely true story, the ball, which was like a lofted 8-iron, hit me on the head, right, as it came down from the middle of the fairway. And it split my head open on the 14th green of Stanmore Golf Course. And I sort of fell to the ground, and but the ball bounced off my head to within about a foot and a half from the hole. And Bryn would not take me to Edgware General Hospital until he'd putted, because he would have got a burst. And he did. So I went to Edgware General Hospital. But in order to put the stitches in, there were quite a lot of stitches in this head wound, they had to shave that side of my head. So 2 days later, as I was... I had to stand up in front of the parents and everyone to do this speech with basically half a head of hair that made me look... I was like a before and after thing for the Harley Hair Clinic. I sort of... massive gash. So I thought, you cannot just give the... say how well the school's done in sport and what universities people have gone to. You're going to have to tell them the story of why you've got a half a head of hair. And so I did. And that was sort of it. Again.
It didn't cross your mind to shave the other half?
No.
Are you a cartoon? This is like an actual comic strip that you're describing as a ball. Just the chances of it hitting you on the head are insane.
Yeah.
And then it bounces into your head. I mean, the only way it could have been more cartoonish and more Mr. Bean-like is if it had bounced off your head into the hole.
But here's the other thing which makes this even more cartoonish. In the same round, so this was the first round of golf I had ever played. It was like the fourth grade. It was a really short par three. I hit the ball pretty much all along the ground and got a hole in one.
You did it. I mean, 200 yard putt.
Yeah. Into the hole and then got knocked out.
How did the parents respond to your new look?
My parents would genuinely have just found that very, very funny. And I think they did. They love stuff like that. Very, very funny people, my parents, without really knowing it.
That's the best. Yeah, the best kind. The ones, the parents who go, you split your head open? Oh, yeah. You
yeah,
idiot.
No, sort of incredibly supportive and just sort of, they didn't mind really at all, actually. To the extent that, so my dad was a bishop, and he was quite a senior bishop in the end. So he was a diocesan bishop. And when I sort of started doing what I do now, one of the first things I did was Spitting Image. And one of the first things on Spitting Image I did was the voice of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And my dad, and it wasn't a very flattering portrait, but my dad very proudly told the Archbishop of Canterbury that I did his voice. Well, that's like career suicide, isn't it?
Had he seen it? Had the Archbishop of Canterbury seen Spitting Image?
Yeah, I would have thought so. Wouldn't you? If you were depicted in Spitting Image, if there was a Rhys James puppet on Spitting Image, you'd be watching, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course, but I'm not in the line of work that the Archbishop of Canterbury is. I mean, I don't know if this guy watches TV, but I don't know. Was he happy that you... Imagine hearing the news, my son does the voice of you. Would he have been like, oh, great, or as it was unflattering, would he have been angry then at your
father?
No,
he didn't seem to be. I met him sort of in passing years afterwards. He seemed to be very happy about it. Very jolly he was.
Forgiveness, innit? It's all about forgiveness. You're bound to go.
Thing. I have played table tennis with the Archbishop of York. Let's not go any further.
Fair enough. Look, I mean, it's a shame there's not more time to delve deeper, but you know, well, I'm happy to take the headlines and then just simply move on. Well, Hugh, it comes to the time in the show where I must score your work on three categories.
Yeah.
There are three categories, obviously, as always. The three categories are originality, pure teen horniness, And Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score, which is how close is it to your work now? How much potential does it show for the future star that you've gone on to be? So first of all, is originality. Now, I don't know. I mean, I would say that the report certainly feels very original for a kid, for me, just because it's got, even referencing the M1 alone, before you get into all the detail about the Watford Gap and the various service stations and just the minutiae of the timings and all of this sort of stuff, I'd say is original. The ballad is very ballady.
Yeah.
Because, and it did remind me of Spike Milligan, the first one. The second one felt very original. Your mum did write some of it.
Is it quite tempting? Are you tempted to set it to music? You know, to put a guitar behind it and...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's sort of like a jangly piano, I think. And actually, your final piece will be set to music.
You'll be pleased to hear. Yeah.
But they, I do find them still very, especially for your age, they feel very original. Especially the fact that you've got your own motif in there. You reference timings again in the ballad.
I tell you what, I've always been slightly worried about in the other ballad. I mean, in fact, no, in that ballad, in the first ballad, the 5D ballad, is that I reference myself. I've never been very comfortable with that. Seems a bit showy-offy, doesn't it?
You make this but whole you do represent ballad. Yourself in a...
Yeah, your whole ballad is really about me.
Yeah, but you swallow a pen, yeah. So, yeah okay, so what you mean is because it's in the third person and you say, and then there was another boy, Peter Dennis, and he did this,
yeah.
You find that embarrassing.
Well, you don't get William Shakespeare, doesn't reference himself, does he, in all his work? He invents someone else.
Well, I'll tell you what's more showy offy is thinking that you're William Shakespeare.
I know.
It's comparing yourself to Shakespeare.
No, I really don't. No.
Well, I'm going to give you a 4 out of 5 for originality,
no,
I think.
Very kind.
It's not really like anything else we've had on early work. So,
what have you mainly had? I mean, clearly, I've listened to every episode so far, but what have you had? Angsty stuff.
Well, the one thing that we have had a lot is that everyone's poems are about this character called Peter Dennis. So
yeah, that's good.
That is the weird thing that's in every episode. But a lot of angsty poetry, some song lyrics. To be honest, it's been a range, but a lot of them follow a sort of heartbreak theme. Or there's only one person I can think of who reminds me a bit of your one. Is Jade Adams did this poem all about the flu that was a bit Spike Milligan.
Yeah.
And just like a sort of very jaunty, gentle poem that was like about a thing. But yours had a dark twist, so still 4 out of 5 for me. The next category is pure teen horniness. Now, I happen to know that a young Peter Dennis was out there in Paris at discos,
yeah,
doing whatever he wanted. So, I know there was a streak running through him, but this is not at all represented in the we got on the M1 at 8 to 9 kind of wording of your work. You swallow a pen. I don't think that's a metaphor for anything.
What if there was a girl out there who was genuinely interested in routes? It was very...
Yeah, it would have to be...
And roads.
It would have to be pretty service
road
station
numbers.
Heavy. Yeah. And radio masks being both metal and wood.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost in negative equity here. I mean, like, score-wise for pure teen horniness. St. Swithin's Day is just not a horny day.
No.
I mean, it's not the first time I've said it, and it won't be the last. It's just not
I don't think St. Swithin is
day.
A horny saint, actually. I mean,
no.
Joan of Arc, to a certain extent. But since Swithin,
sure.
No.
I'll go 0. I've got to go
no,
0
I'll
for 14
go.
Horniness.
Yeah,
it's
go.
Just not
I'm
present.
Not with I'm with you on that. Absolutely.
The final category is the Mickey Mouse Club score. How close is it to your work now? Does it show the potential of a future star? Now, what I would say is that the ballad of 5D is at times quite Radio 4. There's a Radio 4 element to
Listen.
It.
There's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
No, not at all. It's not criticism.
I think probably, to be fair, that is true, I think, because that's all my parents listened to. I kind of grew up on the Today programme. Well, I didn't grow up on the Today programme, clearly.
Yeah.
That would have been very strange.
It wouldn't surprise
listening
me.
Listening to the Today programme, yeah.
There's elements in there of sort of like, I don't know, like maybe it's kind of Pam Ayres type poem in there somewhere. Spike Milligan, obviously, had done stuff for the BBC. It kind of does show that. There's also stuff in like the Jaffa Cakes referencing reminded me of your voiceover work. I just think there's enough in there to give you a bit of a score. St. Swithin's Day, is that the sort of thing that you would go on a tangent about? I think I can imagine sitting next to you on Mock the Week and you bringing up St Swithin's Day in some sort of story, and then it becomes a through line for the episode where you talk about
exactly,
St Swithin's Day a lot in the
well,
way
the
you,
only
in the way you have
ever,
about jam
yeah
and
exactly
stuff.
About marmalade. And let's not go into that because... Yeah.
I'll never stop you.
No.
So I'm going to go for 3 out of 5 for the Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score, which gives you a total of 7 out of 15. Of course, let down by the Horniness score, but that's a positive in many people's eyes. Very respectable score, 7 out of 15.
Is it?
Mid-table. You know.
Is it mid-table score?
Now it comes to the point of the show where I must read you a piece of my work and have you score it in return. Now, I did have an angsty poem to read you, but I do. Now that you've read me the Ballad of 5D, I did find a poem I wrote for my friend for his 18th birthday that references a lot of... It's kind of similar. It's a lot worse, but references a lot of stuff like that. So I'm just going to grab that instead because I think that's more appropriate. So
it's good that you still have access to all this stuff. I had to... it was a tremendous effort for me. You appear to be just sort of... reaching across to a shelf where you have all this stuff surrounding you in a kind of comfort kind of way.
Until now, everything has just been a saved file on a laptop that I've just kept. It's all poems. But in this case, I went home recently and then went through an attic because I was running out of stuff and just found loads and loads of... A lot of it's art. A lot of it's like a weird drawing I did of a steeple piercing a cloud with the lightning coming out of it and tears.
Nice.
It's just insane stuff that makes no sense. Or... Yeah, there's anti-capitalist art everywhere. I don't know how that... I don't really understand that. I'm a keen capitalist now, as you know. But, okay, so here it is. This is for my friend Sam Brennan, who, by the way, for listeners, recently had a number one with... he did the remix of the Well A Man Sea Shanty and went to number one. But here's... This is in the heady days before that. I wrote him this poem. I'm kind of embarrassed to read it, by the way, because I know how bad this is and how rushed it was compared to your ballad, which is basically flawless. But here we go. 18 years since you got born, on a crisp, cold winter morn, drank some milk from Ali's teat. With 4 years done, fate made us meet. One morning we awoke, bright-eyed, probably arrogant, secretly petrified, with grey and yellow matching clothes, my curtained hair, your freckled nose. In no time we were back at yours, pretending we were breaking laws. I faked a motorbike on a rocking horse. You hit the air with a crowbar, of course. The playground date all said and done, we grew a bit, you more than some, and went to Luton to have an act. With Mickey and Lee, we made a pact. One of us said, I quite like girls, we both agreed, then love unfurled, as Melanie would call us cute, and we'd take the hard-to-get route. The stage was lit and we sat atop. Your pocket trapped a certain prop. I said just mime, but you were quick. You artfully dodged and your pocket ripped. Oliver over, we brought some skates. Went to the Pioneer and made more mates. Our love was Solomon. He knew how to roll. But like it all, it took its toll. So there we were, stood in my garage. Don't get upset, this might disparage, but you ran in front of my dartboard, so my brother DDT'd you on my floor. Months later, it was Christmas time. We killed 500 Dynasty Warriors at mine. Then popped to Dixon's for a webcam each. 20 quid. Lab tech. What a peach. Of course, the acting did not stop. I asked if you'd seen James Bond or not. You said yes. I called your bluff. It's about the world not being enough. And then we went to Roundwood Park. Did a shit showcase about Detention Lark. We knew it was shit, but then we did it again. Timmy Twink, MC Rizzler, such hideous men. In the meantime, we bounced well until the stage and table fell. Yeah, why was all we had to know? Judd, Les, Eric and Ralph on show. But that we headlined. We fucking headlined. I said we headlined. And that's the end.
It's
of
beautiful. The rhyme is great at the end.
Yeah, so
well, I've got a score on that. I think that is a lot more complicated. What in terms of meter, what would you say metrically,
yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But I don't think I stuck to a meter, really. A lot of the syllables are all over the
shop. Great. But one
it's basically obviously just a bunch of private jokes between me and a guy. But clearly we were in Oliver together and we got into skating, essentially.
That was the bit I didn't... And who's Tea?
That's his mum's name. So drank some milk from Ali's Tea. It's such a weird
thing
to reference.
That's a really, really odd thing, isn't it? And did your friendship survive that? I mean, I'm not sure you can make references to your friend's mum, can you? Like that?
It did survive it, and I mean, I wonder if I even gave this to him, if this would be the first time he hears it. But I do. There's quite a romantic moment when I say.
Big assumption there that he's listening.
Oh, he'll be listening. Oh, he'll be listening. Yeah. There's a really romantic bit of my curtained hair, your freckled nose. It's just so.
Yeah, no, that's
for someone who's just a.
Yeah. Yeah. If there are any psychologists listening, that would be interesting.
Exactly.
But I
just for a bit of context for the ending, just so you've got it, that we headlined, I said we fucking headlined thing, is that we had to do a show. We were clearly doing bouncers at school in drama and we had to do a showcase and they just put us last on the billing. And being a little shit at sort of 16, we sort of were all just like, oh, we're headlining the music festival of these little plays we're doing. And then everyone got very upset and it became a year-wide issue of how, like, the teacher had to go on record as be like, it was random. It wasn't, and then I was like, yeah, 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 but we know that really You Know Ours was the best and we were headlining, and it was a huge, huge issue. But all because we were just being pricks.
Yeah.
So I need your scores. So out of five for each. First up, it's originality. What are you giving that for?
Originality, I would give that, this is out of five, you say? Or out of ten?
Yeah.
Out of five. Well, I felt it was slightly derivative, I'm not quite sure what of. I would say I'd give that a three. I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take it. Yeah. I'll take it. It didn't feel original to me. I mean, it's very specific because it's about something, but it's kind of, you know, these are ten a penny. Okay. How about pure teen horniness?
Well, in a rather unexpected way, the reference to Ali's teat and your freckled nose.
Curtained hair.
Curtained hair.
Yeah.
What kind of curtains were they? Were they kind of ruched
hemmed?
Beautiful. Well, I'd give that a four. I mean, I think there is a certain amount of unrequited.
There's even I quite like girls, and then a girl called Melanie calling us cute.
Yeah,
and us playing hard to get. It all. Feels
I'm kind of
very,
feeling there's quite a lot of kind of unrequited longing going on in that poem.
Yeah, I don't remember it, but I mean, I've read that myself and it does
feel
I would
like
agree.
It. Yeah.
Not something I'm interested in delving into this second, but it's we get to the last thing, which is Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. How close is it to my work now? Does it show the potential for what you know me to be and do?
I've never heard you do a poem. You do some quite long scenes, don't you, that are quite...
Here it comes. It's all coming out now, is it?
They're quite sort of rhythmic and involved.
Typical
aren't
Hugh,
they?
Looking at his watch the whole time. Every time I stand up in the middle,
get
and go,
on with it.
45 seconds. Come on, man.
Leave it. I don't. Well, you know, in terms of the fact that you were happy to write, I mean, there must be so many people who've never written anything like that. I would say that I'd give that another three. I'd say that points towards your future career.
Fair enough. There's gags in there, but they're just quite niche and they're quite. I mean, they're personal. It's full of personal jokes that it would just take. Every line is kind of that. It would take so long to explain. So, I mean, yeah, I'll take it. I'll take three out of five.
But you also know, don't you? You know, like all comedians know that half of it is rhythm, though, isn't it? You know, if you watch Dinner Ladies, you know, Victoria Wood's Dinner Ladies, for example, it's all rhythm. It's all rhythm jokes. Very, very funny rhythm jokes, but.
Yeah, so I'll take a 3 out of 5, which gives me a 10 in total out of 15.
Oh, you've beaten me. Oh, sod you. No,
I have beaten you.
Okay, it was much less horny than I thought.
Well, we'll clip that sentence as the trailer. What I would say is, as I say on every episode, the scores are irrelevant, there are no winners, we are both losers. That's very much the message of early work. And now we come to the final piece, the final performance piece, where you will play us out with a piece of your choosing that will be produced up. We will put music under, sound effects if we need to, and it will give the performance that you would have wanted as a child. So what have you got for us here?
I've only got two pages of this and it doesn't end, but it's clearly I must have liked it because I kept it. Everything else would be on a bonfire, either of my own making or my parents, who were very, remarkably unsentimental about stuff like that. I think it's a sort of murder mystery. It's a little murder mystery story that I haven't actually read at all yet. So this is the first time I've read this since I was however old I was. I think this is when I was 11 as well. Clearly when I was 11, I kept a lot of stuff because I was...
This is your output.
I think it's because I was before the age of self-consciousness, where you would just put it through a shredder, wouldn't you?
Yeah, pre-shame murder mystery. I love it.
Okay, so I think it needs sort of murder mystery music. It doesn't go, clearly doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't have a denouement.
That'll be fun for the sound effects for the ending, for it to just sort of dwindle, just to hang there.
All right, I'm going to... Okay, here we go. It doesn't have a title, anyway. There have been quite a few kidnappings recently around the Barnstable Exeter area. Right here. Inspector... I'm going to start again. Mind you, that might not be how it makes it onto the podcast. But anyway, in this version, I'm starting again. There have been quite a few kidnappings recently from around the Barnstable Exeter area. Right here. Detective Inspector Stevens jabbed his biro onto the map and made a thick red circle around the appropriate area. Strangely, they've all been young people and not from particularly rich families, so we have no idea what the motive can be. So where do I come in? Said a voice owned by a fair-haired man by the name of Thompson. The total so far is 21, and they wouldn't be at all surprised if there was another. That's where you come in, said Stevens. Hmm? What on earth do you mean? Said a bewildered Thompson. You, my friend, are going to be kidnapped, said Stevens in a very low voice. We've had a tip-off from the Barnstable police that a certain Mr. James Payton is going to be kidnapped. So you, my dear fellow, are now Mr. James Payton. That afternoon, Thompson went down to Payton's house. It was quite a nice day, and he didn't really feel like driving a car, especially someone else's. He felt very uncomfortable in Payton's clothes. In fact, in everything he had on. Everything he was wearing were Payton's. He was even wearing Payton's socks. He felt like a dummy on which you put clothes to show off in a shop window. Suddenly, a car pulled right across his path and stopped. Two masked men came over to his car. The next thing he knew was that he was on some kind of sea transport. Clearly missed quite a big chunk. Which type? This is great, because I need to specify here. Which type of sea transport? He did not know, as he was locked in what seemed to be some sort of cabin. 2 hours later, the ship stopped abruptly, and he was ordered out of his cabin onto the deck. The hydrofoil, as it was, seemed to have docked on a small, barren island, the most striking feature of which was a large complex of white domed buildings, which to Thompson looked like laboratories. On the quay, there was a rather strange vehicle, which resembled a German half-track. This, he presumed, was to take him to the complex, and he was right. Once inside the complex, he was taken to some quarters in which he stayed locked in until one of the scientists came to take him to their head, Dr. Wilkinson. Wilkinson was a fat man who looked rather like a prize tomato, and also a mean and cruel man. Cautiously, Thompson asked him why he had been kidnapped. Surprisingly, and that's where that's the...
Oh, my God. That is the biggest cliffhanger I've ever
surprisingly
heard. Oh, what an ending. That's like a record scratch, I think it's got to be almost.
Well, you can't stop there, Mr. Derek.
So did you stop there or have you just lost the other page?
No, I've lost the other page. Yeah, I don't know where it is.
Oh, well, I mean, it's fantastic. We just get all the setup, all the information of this... Yeah. Sting operation. There's a few things I'll just quickly reference, which are classic Dennis jabbed his biro onto the map. You'd have bloody loved that.
I did love it, yeah. Circled it in red. I've done that.
There was a brief... Yeah, of course you have. Orienteering, I imagine. Brief moment where you forgot both the words mannequin and boat, and you just used... He was on some sort of sea vessel, and then the other one with the mannequin one was, you say, he felt like a dummy you'd use in a shop to put clothes on to show what the clothes are like.
I don't think I knew the word mannequin. I don't think I'd have forgotten it. I mean, it's a very funny word, isn't it, mannequin?
Exactly, and specificity, of course, is the key to comedy. And yeah, I really like the way you described. Dr. Wilkinson was a fat man who looked like a prized tomato, but also looked like a mean and cruel man.
I mean, he looked like a mean and cruel prized tomato. I dismissed that.
Yeah. All you got to do is just put that together. It's great, and what an ending. I mean, what a way to end a story. Surprise. More stories should end like that, really. Just surprisingly, ... And then imagine getting to the end of a book and it's that. Oh, I like it. New genre.
I was wondering actually whether I had created my own advert break at that point.
Yeah. That was just room for you to come in with Jaffa Cakes and tuna and sweet corn. There it was, Hugh Dennis. What a special guest he was. Bit of an abrupt ending there, but that's what I have to work with recording-wise. Go and... You can't even follow Hugh, actually. He's not on social media, so go and do nothing. Maybe what you should do
is subscribe to my other podcast, Fit and Proper, in which we invite a guest on to take over a football club of their choice and do nonsense stuff like, you know, so far people have put a bee's nest above the away fans or a big go ape above the pitch. In case you get bored and you want a different kind of view, all sorts of nonsense stuff happens on there. You don't need to like football to like it. Guests so far include, you know, your classics, Rob Beckett, Sarah Keyworth, Ian Sterling, Tom Rosenthal, Chloe Petz, all the usual suspects. Go and check that out. Chuck this one a review if you fancy, but who cares? Ultimately, just enjoy yourselves, enjoy your lives, enjoy Hugh Dennis, and enjoy saying I love you to a stranger. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.